and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of where U.S. foreign policy is heading as Trump purges his White House of any critical or cautionary voices while he installs his new, more agreeable Secretary of State, proclaiming Mike Pompeo has, quote, a very similar thought process to his. Michael Fuchs, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, a special advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogue, and a member of the policy planning staff, joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, Rex Tillerson Was Disastrous for the U.S., Mike Pompeo May Be Worse. We will look into what letting Trump be Trump will look like as the last remaining adults in the room are shown the door and General McMaster is replaced by John Bolton, who is rumored to be the next national security advisor. He, along with Pompeo, will be enabling an insecure narcissist and weak strongman with an infantile fascination with bigness, toughness, and power, along with contempt for diplomacy. Then we'll speak with Tom Adams, a retired attorney who co-authored an article in the San Francisco Chronicle with a former U.S. attorney, Dennis Aftergut. Russian criminals' links to Trump could compromise him, and have written an extensive investigative report, which is at the website of Congresswoman Jackie Speier, The Trump Organization, a Racketeering Enterprise. We will discuss how Trump has laid down a red line with the Mueller investigation not to look into the family business, but whatever crimes Mueller might uncover, Trump's pardon power does not extend to state crimes, and that both RICO, the Racketeering and Corrupt Organization Act, and New York law could be used against him. Then finally, we will speak with two young students who walked out of class today, joining a nationwide demonstration of tens of thousands of high school students demanding action to stop gun violence 1 month after the mass shooting of high school students in Florida. 16-year-old Mackenzie Matone, who organized a student walkout at Benjamin Cardoza High School in New York City, joins us first. Then we'll hear from 17-year-old Jatsiri Campos at Muchen College Prep, a charter school in gun-plagued downtown Chicago. And joining us now is Michael Fuchs, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues. He also served as a member of the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff, where he worked on a diverse set of issues and initiatives, including the State Department's response to the Arab Spring, cybersecurity, and the development of a U.S. government strategy to prevent and respond to mass atrocities. He co-authored The Survival and the Success of Liberty, A Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy with Morten Halperin. And he has an article at The Guardian, Rex Tillerson Was Disastrous for the U.S., Mike Pompeo May Be Worse. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Fuchs.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Michael. And of course, I guess John Bolton would have been even worse, right? So are we doing to be grateful for small mercies here?
Well, I guess everything is relative, especially in the era of Donald Trump.
Right. But
I think that this is one of those cases where for a year plus, many people, including myself, have been very disappointed in the tenure of Rex Tillerson at the State Department and have been, frankly, wishing that he might resign or be fired. And yet we may end up being careful what we wished for. With Mike Pompeo at the helm of the State Department, if he's to be confirmed by the Senate. I think that, you know, Rex Tillerson obviously was a disaster for the department in terms of its management. He completely mismanaged the organization, forced out a lot of professional career diplomats at all levels, and really created a hostile work environment, and seemingly also only focused on a handful of issues, eschewing many important challenges around the world. That said, he, in many cases, was reportedly a reasonable voice of moderation within the Trump administration, from urging the president to stay in the Paris Climate Agreement to encouraging the president to stick to the Iran nuclear deal, to encouraging diplomacy with North Korea. And with Mike Pompeo set to take over the State Department, potentially, he seems to have much more hawkish views on all of these issues. dating back a number of years. And so, again, we may find ourselves in a situation with one less voice of moderation at the National Security Council table when this is all said and done.
Well, the president has already said with Mike Pompeo, we have a very similar thought process. I think it's going to go very well. And that in itself is frightening because in Donald Trump, you have a kind of insecure narcissist, which is a paradox in itself, a weak, strong man, somebody that is a serial liar, con man, and a fraud who's overcompensating all the time and surrounds himself with generals. And, I mean, I'm assuming that Trump is the person that's driving this entire shift in U.S. foreign policy, where we're just throwing more and more money at American hard power, whether we need it or not, and cutting the budget for soft power by one-third. Somebody's driving that process, and as far as I can tell, it's Donald Trump, and that Tillerson was executing those priorities, as are the rest of the crew. So if you've got somebody that's compatible with Trump, he's either a sycophant or a co-conspirator.
No, that's absolutely right. And look, at the end of the day, obviously, the president of the United States sets the direction for foreign policy, and especially, again, in this era of, you know, Donald Trump's uniquely erratic foreign policy, it is difficult to know where we'll go, regardless of who's running the different cabinet agencies. But absolutely, Mike Pompeo seems to be much more of a kindred spirit with Donald Trump, or at the very least, much more willing to toe President Trump's line on key issues. We've seen him do this repeatedly, not just in terms of policy positions on issues from North Korea to Iran and so on, but we've also seen him as director of the CIA be unwilling to defend publicly the agency and the intelligence community from his own president's repeated attacks on the integrity of the intelligence agency. There was also an incident last fall where President Trump asked Mike Pompeo to take a meeting with a conspiracy theorist that was peddling this theory that the hacks of the DNC during the 2016 election was an inside job by the Democrats. And Mike Pompeo took the meeting willingly. And so, again, I think the danger here is very much that we have someone who may just be willing to fall in line and do what the president wants on a wide variety of issues. And while Secretary Tillerson absolutely, I think, saluted his boss and went ahead with this, trying to dismantle the State Department on policy issues at the very least, while he was a good soldier in pushing forward with what the president wanted, he at least reportedly fought many and consistent battles with the president internally on the direction of policy. And Mike Pompeo may not even do that.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Fuchs, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and the Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues. He also served as a member of the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff, where he worked on a diverse set of issues and initiatives, including the State Department's response to the Arab Spring, cybersecurity, and the development of a U.S. government strategy to prevent and respond to mass atrocities. He co-authored The Survival and the Success of Liberty, a Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy with Morten Halperin, and has an article at The Guardian, Rex Tillerson was disastrous for the U.S., Mike Pompeo may be worse. Now, one of the more alarming things about the firing of Tillerson, not that it was unexpected, and certainly I suppose we shouldn't be surprised by the absolutely tawdry and unnecessarily humiliating way that Trump fired his Secretary of State by tweet, and only 3 hours later had the courtesy and decency to call him on the phone, and then he had to negotiate to stay on to get a transition underway. So, I mean, from what you've said, Michael, there's no reason why we should shed a tear for him in terms of the destruction he's done to the State Department. But as a human being, he seemed to be relatively decent in that pantheon of bottom feeders that Trump has brought into government.
Well, look, absolutely. And again, I think that, you know, uniquely in the era of Donald Trump, he has an ability, the president does, to make even other unsavory characters feel sorry for, you know, the ability to, you know, Donald Trump gives you the ability, like in the movie, to sort of empathize with the villain, sometimes, if you will. But I think that's absolutely right. And here, again, I think this is one of the real questions we have going forward with Mike Pompeo coming forward, which is that, you know, Secretary Tillerson has, as we pointed out, tremendous faults, both in terms of a manager as well as on the substance of policies. But for better or for worse, he clearly saw himself as a someone who was modest and, frankly, as a gentleman, someone who was honest and someone who was going to tell it like he saw it and be straightforward. And I have endless criticisms of him on both fronts, the management and the substance, but that was at least a credit, I think, to him. And, of course, the way in which the president discarded him is just really disgusting. Mike Pompeo taking over for Secretary Tillerson is much more of a politician, which may enable him to get things done that Secretary Tillerson was unable to. But again, also seems like he will be much more of a Donald Trump stooge, if you will. And that could portend all sorts of bad things for the State Department and for U.S. foreign policy.
But the issue, it seems, at least the straw that broke the camel's back with Tillerson, apparently, was that he had gone public with criticism of Russia being behind the nerve gas attack in the UK after having spoken with the foreign minister of the UK, Boris Johnson. At the same time, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Trump's spokesperson, was saying there was no evidence and they weren't about to accuse Russia of anything. And to this day, to this moment, Donald Trump still, he made a perfunctory statement, well, at least the White House did, that they agreed with the British assessment, but he himself has not said a peep. This was the use of a weapon of mass destruction against a NATO ally, and it turns out to be a very advanced form of nerve gas or a nerve agent that only the Russians have developed. It's even more lethal than VX, and it's been identified. So it's pretty unequivocal what happened there, and we don't know what's going on with Russia, why Putin is unleashing the FSB thugs. Throughout the Cold War, we had a kind of an understanding, spy versus spy. They weren't assassinating each other. So it's a scary thing that's going on there, that he's unleashing sort of thugs and amateurs with access to lethal weaponry on foreign soil of a NATO ally. And so far, our president hasn't said a damn thing, and that is consistent with his blind spot vis-a-vis Putin, where he will never criticize this Russian leader. And that leads to all kinds of speculation. So what will happen with Pompeo in that regard? Because there's been some troubling indications that he, early on, he said that there was no collusion and then had to, the CIA pressured him to revise those remarks. Will he be another enabler like the Republicans are the enablers, for reasons I don't understand why they're not standing up for America and American allies against a really despicable attack by a hostile foreign power?
Yeah, no, and I think this is really the big takeaway from the events of the last few days, which is a giant question mark hanging over the future of American foreign policy under this administration. Obviously, it has had its ups and mostly its downs. And the president, who clearly, when it comes to a lot of issues, but in particular Russia, just seems frankly unwilling to stand up for the United States. And I think that what we have coming up just in the next few months, frankly, is terrifying on the foreign policy front in terms of serious decisions that will need to be made. Obviously, first, there's the Russia piece, and that's across the board from these attacks on foreign soil to ongoing election meddling by the Russians, not just from 2016, but for our current elections coming up in the fall of 2018 and beyond, and how the United States will respond to those. Second is the Iran deal, which the president seems once again to be hinting more and more at the possibility that he may withdraw the United States from. And the fallout from that in the Middle East right now is very, very difficult to predict. And then third, of course, North Korea. I mean, he announced one day that he was going to do an unprecedented meeting with the leader of North Korea, pulling a 180, and then 5 days later announces that his Secretary of State, presumably would have been in the lead of these negotiations, is gone, and we don't have a confirmed Secretary of State, or won't for a little while. And so, again, there are major challenges out there for the United States right now, and our foreign policy is in turmoil. And I think that Mike Pompeo has proven himself again in recent years to unfortunately be someone just much more willing to toe the line of his boss, regardless of what he thinks. He was a vocal critic of Vladimir Putin in Russia when he was in the House of Representatives. But since becoming a Trump administration cabinet official, has taken a very different approach to this issue. And so, again, if that continues when he is at the State Department, then I fear that we will see, again, more enabling of President Trump's unwillingness to stand up to Vladimir Putin.
Well, it's gone beyond unwillingness. It's sort of flagrant and reached a point of a lot of people are speculating that there's some kind of blackmail or there's something that Putin holds over him. And this is not idle kind of speculation, because the former head of U.S. intelligence, General Clapper, said that he thinks that Vladimir Putin is Donald Trump's case officer. And that's about as stark a warning as you can get, that we have some kind of Manchurian candidate here. And now we learn, of course, that apparently the Russians urged Trump through some back channel, which we're not yet aware of, not to hire Mitt Romney as his Secretary of State, but to hire Tillerson, which, of course, in the current situation is somewhat ironic. So, again, this is the reality that's out there. You're sort of hovering on speculating about the very nature of treason itself being involved here. We desperately need to know what this peculiar connection is. But at what point does Trump's fealty to Putin and the hawkish nature of his foreign policy, particularly now with a more hawkish Secretary of State, who may well, you know, the only other adult there that apparently can influence Trump in any way is the Secretary of Defense. And if McMaster's purged, which I think will happen as well, Pompeo could be Trump's number one advisor, given how much how they get on together. So that has implications for Syria. It has implications for Iran, because in May, I'm sure they're going to pull out of the Iran deal. And of course, again, what does that do? That affects our relationship with our allies more than our adversaries, doesn't it?
No, absolutely. And again, this is just one of those many just grave foreign policy challenges that are confronting us right now, and where there will be potentially very pivotal decisions coming up in the coming months. And on your point on Russia, I mean, absolutely. The questions that people ask in hushed corners of Washington and this country right now about, you know, the true allegiances of our president and what the Russians may have on them are just mind-blowing. And, you know, obviously, Special Counsel Robert Mueller is deep on his way in investigating this case, and may very well be the only person in this town right now who is actually able to unearth some of the truth here. It's clear the House Intelligence Committee is not doing it, and the Senate Intelligence Committee is not moving very quickly either on this. And so I think that he is going to be, Special Counsel Mueller, really the person to look to on answering that question. But in terms of what a policy actually looks like under this administration towards Russia, it is very clear, and has been from day one, to both Democrats and Republicans in Washington that President Trump's hand will need to be forced to do anything to safeguard U.S. interests when it comes to Russia. That's why Congress passed a veto-proof set of sanctions, which, of course, this administration has not actually yet begun to genuinely implement. It's why you've seen other aspects of the U.S. government, such as the Defense Department and the State Department, take actions like selling more lethal weapons to Ukraine in its fight against Russia. And so, again, when you put someone in the head of the State Department at a place where they may be able to do certain things to push back on Russian destabilizing behavior, you put someone like Mike Pompeo there, who is much more willing to take Donald Trump's direction on the relationship with Russia, and it makes it very, very scary that we may not be able to even protect certain interests against Russia, despite the fact that our president, of course, is unwilling to do so, and maybe worse.
Well, yesterday I spoke with a former State Department official, and I made the point that what goes on in the White House sounds a little bit like a preschool, where the president is a sort of, you know, petulant kindergarten child who doesn't like being told bad news, doesn't listen to people who disagrees with him or tells him stuff he doesn't want to hear, and just shuns them, turns his back, even gets bored in the middle of meetings with foreign leaders and sort of rolls his eyes and turns his head or gets up and walks away. This is an extraordinary behavior. So you've got this infant in the Oval Office with not just the nuclear codes, but a propensity to hang out with generals who he likes, to act tough, to throw money at the Pentagon, to basically diss diplomacy. You know, they purged all of the senior diplomats. And even at the CIA replacement, you've got somebody that comes out of operations, not out of analysis. So that's another move in a hawkish direction. So you've got the gathering of the hawks. You've got a leader who is sort of childlike and wants to play with all these massive military toys he's got and wants to keep building more and more and keeps talking about strength and power. And that seems to be, I don't know whether, you know, at the risk of getting into AMA psychiatrics, you know, whether it's to do with overcompensating or what, but let's just deal with it on the factual level as opposed to the psychological speculation. This is a weak, strong man with a propensity to use force and to talk tough. When's he going to do something? Because we've not had a crisis so far, but we've had nothing but chaos in this White House. What happens when we have a crisis?
Nope, and I think that that's a question that we've all been waiting about 14 months right now to for the answer to. It's been almost lucky that this White House has not been presented with a genuine crisis so far. But it's very, very, very rare that a president will get this far into a presidency, and let alone full 4 years of a presidency, without a genuine national security crisis. And that is a terrifying prospect for us all. And I think what is just as terrifying is that you mentioned John Bolton at the very beginning as, you know, someone whose name keeps popping up for national security positions. The one question now is this just the beginning of another personnel shift in this administration? People clearly do not last very long at senior positions in the Trump administration. And we keep hearing rumors again about H.R. McMaster potentially being ousted at some point in the near future. John Bolton has met a number of times with the president in the Oval Office in recent months. Clearly is one of his favorite people out there, talking about North Korea and Iran, and it is a truly terrifying prospect that Bolton might succeed H.R. McMaster. And then even beyond that, John Kelly, of course, there have been rumors for months now about how long he is for the White House Chief of Staff's office. And again, one truly terrifying prospect is that some of these senior officials in the administration begin to cycle out themselves, and we get they get replaced with the C team or the D team or worse, of officials who are much more willing to take the president's impulsive decisions on issues of war and peace and go ahead and implement them. And I think that, again, this is a real challenge that we have right now. And, you know, for all of his faults, losing Rex Tillerson means losing one more voice of relative sanity at the National Security Council table.
Well, but you're not speculating, just in closing, Michael, because it's actually happening, and Trump has said this. He said he's kind of cleaning house and getting people in. He wants his team. He sort of wants, in other words, he's saying, let Trump be Trump, and I'm going to make sure that Trump is going to be Trump. So worse is to come. That and Bolton is indeed apparently the leading candidate for National Security Advisor. So that in itself is a nightmarish prospect. So I thank you for joining us.
No, that's my pleasure.
I thank you for depressing us.
Anytime.
Okay. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Fuchs, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues. He also served as a member of the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff, where he worked on a diverse set of issues and initiatives, including the State Department's response to the Arab Spring, cybersecurity, and the development of U.S. government strategy to prevent and respond to mass atrocities. He co-authored The Survival and the Success of Liberty, a Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy with Morten Halperin, and has an article at The Guardian, Rex Tillerson Was Disastrous for the U.S., Mike Pompeo May Be Worse. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into an extensive new investigative report on whether the Trump Organization is a racketeering enterprise.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clouds. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours. Making my entrance again with my youth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Tom Adams, a founding partner at Adams, Broadwell, Joseph & Cardoza, and a retired attorney who has an article at the San Francisco Chronicle with a former federal prosecutor, Dennis Afagat. Russian criminals linked to Trump could compromise him, and they have an extensive investigative report at the website of Representative Jackie Speier, The Trump Organization, a Racketeering Enterprise? Question. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Adams.
Thank you very much.
And there's been a great deal of puzzlement about why it is that Donald Trump can never say a bad word about Russia and their activities, and in particular Vladimir Putin. It's particularly stark now that the Russians have used a weapon of mass destruction, a Soviet-era nerve gas on British soil. This is about the 15th attack on British soil, Britain, of course, being a NATO member. We haven't heard a peep out of Donald Trump about it. In fact, it looks as though his Secretary of State may well have been fired because he spoke out about it, condemned it along with the British Foreign Minister, and while the White House was remaining silent. So one of the speculations that's rampant, there are lots of speculations, but at the end of the day, people are wondering, what is it that Putin has over Trump? Why does he not speak out and defend the United States even when our elections are attacked? And it looks as though you and your co-author may be onto what the reasons are. So are you confident that you're heading in the right direction with your new report, The Trump Organization, a Racketeering Enterprise?
We feel that the evidence here is pretty overwhelming. All the evidence that we've gathered is from public sources. It's been out in the open for some period of time, and none of it has been refuted. If you examine the evidence, what you find are patterns of conduct that are strongly suggestive of money laundering in a series of real estate projects. And coincidentally, Russians continued to play a key role in these investments, and it's really hard to imagine that the Russian government, Vladimir Putin, are not aware of felonies that may have been committed in the course of these projects and the compromising activity that, or the compromise that they may have on him. Could easily consist of a series of major financial crimes.
Well, most recently, and as you point out in your article in the San Francisco Chronicle, Russians criminals links to Trump could compromise him. The activity that went on down in Panama at the Trump Ocean Club Panama was pretty flagrant, wasn't it? The Trump people are frantically shredding every document they get hands on, with their security protecting the shredding while the new owner of the building is trying to take over. And by the way, the guy that brokered the deal for them, the former president of Panama, who was there in all the photo ops with Ivanka Trump, who led the deal, he's on the lam, is he not? He's wanted for crimes in Panama itself.
Yes, he is. He's on the lam in the United States.
Right. So tell us about that one. That seems to be... that's the most flagrant example, isn't it, of a money laundering operation, because most of the condos were bought with cash by Russian gangsters.
A lot of them were bought all cash by shell companies that were linked to Russian criminals. Several of them were purchased by people who were involved in drug trafficking in Central and South America. And a prosecutor who looked into this in Panama said that he thought the Trump organization, that the Trump Ocean Club in Panama City was a vehicle for money laundering.
So that leads to the question, is the Trump family business model based on money laundering?
You know, it certainly appears to be the case. If you look at several of these projects as we examined them in the Chronicle, these four hotel projects in Panama and Toronto and New York City and Baku, Azerbaijan, a pattern emerges with indicia of money laundering written all over it, and you know it appears to be a business model of the Trump organization. I mean, let me ask you this question: the luxury hotel business, which is what they were trying to be in, is a very competitive business, and it's run by a number of top firms with highly skilled professionals. If you were going to compete in that industry, wouldn't you want to hire some of the best hospitality industry professionals that you could find? Why, instead, would you bring criminals into your organization? The only reason you would bring the criminals in is if they offered something of value to you that you needed or wanted. Otherwise, you'd hire the best hotel professionals that money could buy. In each of these instances, the Trump organization had criminals that were playing key roles. And surprise, each of these facilities failed as a commercial enterprise. The nominal enterprise, the obvious enterprise to the public, failed. But what was happening behind the curtain is key. Behind the curtain, there's indicia of money laundering in each of these projects.
Well, even in Trump Tower itself, which is Trump's residence in New York City, there was a weekly gambling game that was hosted by one of the Russian gangsters who has a condo in the building. And my sense is that what Trump was signaling, not just to Russian mobsters and kleptocrats, but also to Indonesians and Turks and you name it, every third world crook, it was basically an open invitation to invest in Trump properties. And that seems to be, I mean, literally when the first, after he'd announced his running for president at Trump Tower, when he insulted Mexicans, the next photo op he had was with a Indonesian bagman for General Prabowo. And he told the press there gathered, we're going to make some great foreign policy deals, and showed this guy off. And the guy literally is the bagman for one of the kleptocrats that have looted Indonesia.
I think that's right. You're referring to the Bali Hotel in Indonesia, a project that is in a very corrupt country. The people that Donald Trump was dealing with have reputations for being very corrupt. They've been accused of major crimes, including soliciting bribes. You know, there's corruption all over that project. Just going back briefly to what you mentioned about the Trump Tower in New York, in 1984, there was a Russian named David Bogatin who purchased 5 units in the Trump Tower for $6 million in cash. At the time, that was so unusual that Donald Trump himself personally attended the closing. But just 3 years later, Bogatin was caught by the FBI, taking part with Russian mobsters in a gasoline bootlegging scheme, and the FBI seized his 5 condos at Trump Tower, saying that they had been purchased to launder money and hide assets. Then, you know, that should have made any reasonable businessman very suspicious. But it turned out, as you say, 29 people were subsequently arrested, this time in 2013, for running a gambling ring out of an entire floor of one of the Trump Tower condos. The one guy who escaped, a Russian named Alimjan, forgive me if I don't pronounce this correctly, Totak Klunov, managed to get away. And where was he next seen? He was next seen in the VIP section near Donald Trump at the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow. And he remains to this day a fugitive from United States justice.
And, of course, there's the Baku disaster that, again, it seems like Trump uses Ivanka as a kind of pretty face behind these dirty deals.
Ivanka Trump has played a very curious role, and I think the project you're mentioning in Baku, Azerbaijan, is one. That hotel was supposed to be a luxury hotel, but it was located on the wrong side of town. It was located in a very seedy neighborhood where no one who wanted to stay in a luxury hotel would ever go. Ivanka Trump visited that hotel. In fact, she went there and increased the cost of various interior design features. How could she not have known that that hotel was never feasible as a commercial investment? And in fact, it never was. Even though the project, the construction, which was phenomenally expensive and paid for with duffels of cash, even though the construction on that hotel has been completed, essentially, the hotel has never opened. And after Donald Trump was elected in 2016, but before he was inaugurated, the Trump Organization said they were dropping the project, probably to shield themselves from ongoing questions concerning it. But the fact that it's never opened makes you wonder whether or not there was any point in running the hotel at all, or whether or not all the profit was going to be made by excessive costs incurred during construction.
And, of course, the people that financed that building, or the family that were behind the Baku Tower, referred to as the Corleones of the Caspian, reference there to the movie The Godfather, they're related. Their daughter was married to Amin Agalarov, the guy that set up the meeting in Trump Tower, whose father is a friend of Putin's and a big developer in Moscow. And they were the people that underwrote the Miss Universe in Moscow in 2013, where there's allegations of some bizarre sexual behavior that might have taken place in the Steele dossier. So all of these links. Now, this is what I find interesting. Your investigation, which you've done with the former federal prosecutor, Dennis Aftergut, is at the website of Representative Jackie Speier. It's called The Trump Organization, a Racketeering Enterprise. It's got an enormous amount of footnotes to it, and it's very, very thorough, and she's recommending it very highly. And she's a member of the House Intelligence Committee that's basically become defunct. So it feels to me like the Congresswoman is trying to get the word out. Is that what's going on?
I know that Congresswoman Speier is very concerned about this issue, along with many others, and I'm sure she would be glad to talk with you herself. But I think she should speak for herself.
Sure, but it's true that she's been on that committee, and the committee has been frustrated by Devin Nunes, has it not, and become dysfunctional, and they just declared Trump innocent.
The Republicans are attempting to shut down the intelligence investigation, and it's completely unjustified. It's a charade. Yesterday evening, the Democrats on the Intelligence Committee released a status report. They're going to do a full minority report, but they released a status report. And if you look in there, they say that one of the things that the Republicans were completely unwilling to explore as potential ways in which the president has been compromised are his opaque business dealings and the unusual finances that he has and the problems with a number of these projects. So I think those statements in the status report that the Democrats have issued show that the minority, at least, is strongly concerned that these financial dealings may have been a source of compromise to the president.
Well, Tom Adams, we don't have much time here today on the program. We're about to talk to some young students who, amongst the hundreds of thousands that have demonstrated around the country today. But I'd hope to revisit you and your co-author as well and have a follow-up conversation.
That would be fantastic. We'd love to be helpful to you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Tom Adams, who's a founding partner at Adams, Broadwell, Joseph & Cardoza, and a retired attorney who has an article at the San Francisco Chronicle with a former federal prosecutor, Dennis Daftergat. Russian criminals linked to Trump could compromise him, and they have an extensive investigative report at the website of Representative Jackie Speier, the Trump Organization, a racketeering enterprise. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back speaking with two young students who walked out of class today, joining a nationwide demonstration of tens of thousands of high school students demanding action to stop gun violence 1 month after the mass shooting of high school students in Florida.
It's the money. But it won't be long, 'cause kids with guns, easy does it, easy does it, they got something to say.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is 16-year-old Mackenzie Matone, who is an 11th grade student at Benjamin N. Cardoza High School in New York City, who today organized a student walkout to protest gun violence 1 month after the mass shooting of high school students in Parkland, Florida. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mackenzie Matone.
Thank you.
And Mackenzie, tell us what you did. I mean, you organized your high school, and obviously, the schools across the country are ambivalent. On the one hand, they say they have to follow the rules and they can't accept students taking the law into their own hands, so as to speak. On the other hand, many teachers and school administrators are sympathetic to the cause that students across the country are expressing their support for today. So walk us through what you did.
So initially, I had a little paper printed out that explained what happened on February 14th and what I wanted to do on March 14th, and I had several students sign it, and I made a meeting with my principal, and when I brought her all the signatures, she was like, okay, like we can have the walkout, and she supported it full on, and then I created an information sheet to explain what the procedure was of the walkout and explain the action we were going to take, like registering to vote, and the goals we wanted to come from this walkout. And that was spread around the school.
And, of course, in your case, being 16, you've got two more years to wait. So did you set up a desk to register the older students?
Yes, we have like a date at our high school where everyone can register to vote, and it's very promoted for the 17-year-olds.
Who will presumably turn 18 before November, right?
Yes.
So it sounds like your school principal and administrators were sympathetic. I mean, it's not the case across the country in Texas and Arkansas and other states. The students have been expressly forbidden from participating in this nationwide walkout. But it doesn't seem like the staff at your school were unsympathetic to what you were doing.
Well, I think they shared the same goals as us. They, too, were passionate about having more gun laws, and the people higher up than my principal were also supporting it, like the mayor and the governor, and our, the system of education supporting New York also allowed and said teachers would not be able to penalize their students for leaving.
Well, one of the extraordinary things about what's happening politically is that even though after all of these gun massacres, and they happen with a tragic frequency in this country, a lot of energy politically is spent and various people put forth bills. And it just happened recently in the White House where you had a group of senators and congresspeople sitting around the table with Donald Trump. Lots of promises were made, but nothing ever gets done. That's the pattern. So is that something you detect and your fellow students detect?
Yes, that is why we want people to vote more so that we can get people into office that will actually listen to our demands and will actually take action. And we know that the people in office right now are not taking enough action, and that's why we're hosting these walkouts to have our voices heard and so that they can see the magnitude of the amount of people that want this done.
And in 10 days' time, of course, a lot of the surviving students from the Stoneman Douglas School in Florida, the survivors, they're going to be marching on Washington. So it looks as though the pressure is going to be kept up. Do you see this as a long-term, this is not a one-off demonstration, in other words?
Definitely. Students are not going to stop fighting until the legislation is passed. We are all very passionate about this movement, and I know some students in my school will be going down to Washington to continue fighting.
So when you spoke out today on media in New York, you said we should not have to worry about being shot while sitting at our desk or walking through our halls. I cannot imagine the moment where I witness my own best friends being killed before me, and there is nothing I can do. Is this a feeling that you've had? Is it just subsequent to the massacre in Florida, or has this been with you for some time?
This is subsequent to the massacre in Florida, but as well as like other massacres, like the Sandy Hook, I definitely can remember that. But that feeling was definitely when I later in my speech I explained how while watching those kids in Parkland, I have gained so much more confidence in my voice and how we as teenagers can do something. We can be heard, and we can force legislators to listen to our demands.
So in talking to your parents and students in terms of their dialogues with their parents, it seems to me that what's going on here with students protesting across the country today, and as we mentioned, in 10 days' time, there'll be a march on Washington involving the survivors from the massacre 1 month ago at Parkland in Florida. And it comes down to a simple choice, surely. And the question would be to all parents in this country, what are your priorities? Are they to protect your guns or to protect your children? Is that how you see it?
There really is no debate between that. How can you make the correlation between guns and a life? No parent here is discussing like that with their children. It's just straightforward. We are here to protect you. We will have no intentions of protecting our guns over our children.
But that seems to be the priority of our government, and that's certainly the priority of the National Rifle Association. They operate on the basis that this is to do with freedom and the Constitution and the Second Amendment of the Constitution. So that seems to be the whole argument here that is winning the day so far, which is our priority as a country is to protect our guns, not to protect our children.
Well, that's their interpretation of the Second Amendment of our Constitution. The way I personally interpret, and I know many others interpret our Second Amendment, is the right to bear arms, is the right to protect ourselves. We do not need AR-15s to protect ourselves because those guns have the intent to kill many people at once.
And already, I don't know whether you've noticed, but President Trump came out in favor of raising the minimum age to buy assault rifles from 18 to 21, but he subsequently backed down on that. But the governor of Florida seems to have put that through in his bill, although it's being challenged by the NRA. So that is obviously one of your points too, right?
Yeah.
So your ex-mayor there in New York, of course, has taken on the gun lobby, and he's got a considerable amount of money. But still, they're powerful. What do you think it's going to take? I mean, it seems to me that what's the big change that's taken place, given about how little progress has been made, and as I mentioned, Mayor Bloomberg certainly is not short of a few billion dollars, and he's weighed in trying to level the playing field, but still the NRA seems to be winning. But it seems to me that what you and your fellow students are doing has completely changed the landscape. And there's a whole new player in this stale and deadly non-debate that we've had for decades in this country. So how do you see yourself and your fellow students in that light, in terms of this decades-long non-debate, as I would call it, about gun freedom versus the freedom to stay alive and to be able to go to school, to be able to go to the mall, to be able to go to church without being afraid that you're going to be shot down?
Teenagers right now will soon, we are the next generation, we are the future, and we will be voting in these next midterm elections, and our parents and all of our adults that we know and can influence will all be voting during the midterm elections to put people into office that support greater gun control. So in response to saying I'm going to the movies and going to the mall, we are not going to back down. We are not going to let this fear come over us. We're not going to stop the way we live and how we act, and this isn't going to bring us down.
Well, how do you think your efforts and your fellow students' efforts can be spread nationwide in the sense that we do have a divided country, we have red states and blue states, you're in a blue state that has gun control. I'm talking to you from California, which also has pretty strict gun control compared to the rest of the country, but an awful lot of the country doesn't, particularly in the South and the Midwest. So what would be the strategy? And by the way, there are students protesting right across the country, even though, as I say, in a lot of these red states like Texas and Arkansas, they're preventing these kids from leaving classes and threatening them with suspension, et cetera, or sanctions. But what would your strategy be to spread the word across this divided country?
I think it would be fair to make these people from these schools that are not allowing their students to leave, listen to the stories of the survivors at Parkland and listen to how horrible it was to be in such a position where their friends were being killed right by their side. They have to have sympathy. You can't imagine having that at your own school. Like, their school could be next, and right in Texas, and they'll definitely regret not having their students stand up for what they believe in, especially when applying to colleges. I've heard that colleges have announced that if you were suspended from your school during the walkout, they will not hold that against you.
Well, I thank you for joining us, and I salute you for your efforts today.
Thank you for having me.
And I take it, you know, this is just the beginning for you, right?
Yes.
Okay, bye-bye.
I will definitely keep fighting.
And all the best. And again, I've been speaking with 16-year-old Mackenzie Matone, who is an 11th grade student at Benjamin N. Cardoza High School in New York City, who today organized a student walkout to protest gun violence 1 month after the mass shooting of high school students in Parkland, Florida. And joining us now is 17-year-old Jaziri Campos, who is a student at Mutian College Prep in Chicago. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jaziri Campos.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So tell us what you did today.
So today, when it hit 10, my classmates and I, whoever wanted to participate, we all just walked out of our class in silence. Since we're on the seventh floor of a high-rise building located in One North State, we took the stairways in level zero, as they call it, which is, like, silent, like, nobody like, spoke or anything. And we surrounded Michigan Street, Adams, Wabash, and State Street. And we just held in hands, and we, like, interlocked together. And some people held signs that says, no guns allowed in schools or stuff like that. And it was like a silent protest. We were just there showing our respect for the 17 lives that were lost.
And that sounds like you were right in the heart of downtown Chicago, right?
Yes, that's right.
So what did the Chicagoans think of this? Did traffic stop? Did people comment or observe you? What happened?
Yeah, definitely. Since we are located right at the heart of Chicago, we know that we have a big, like, platform to actually get a message across. Like, we knew that, like, someone was, like, actually going to see us and, like, notice us, you know? So people were, like, clapping for us. Some people were, like, if they were in cars, they were just honking at us. People were, like, yelling at us. Like they're proud of what we were doing because we were, like, you know, speaking up for what we believe and making or trying to make a change.
Well, but you're in a city that has a terrible problem with gun violence.
Mm-hmm.
And how does that impact you personally and your fellow students?
Yeah, actually, we were discussing this once we got back. In Chicago, there's, like, these things happen, like, on a daily. Like, 17 lives are lost, like, within a day. Like, you know, that's, like, a thing that we're used to. And like, in Florida, they're afraid of, like, getting, like, shut up at school. And in here, like, we're not only afraid of getting, like, shot at, like, at school. We're afraid of getting shot at, like, at our house, like, even on our way home or anything. Like, since my school is located downtown, like, most of us, all of us, per se, we have to actually, like, travel all the way to our school. So we all take, like, CTA or stuff like that. And it's, like, dangerous. Like, this is something that, like, we have to worry, like, on a daily. Like, most people don't have to worry about, like, would I be able to come home safe or anything like that.
So, in terms of Chicago, where, as we mentioned, there's an awful amount of gun violence on a regular basis, one of the justifications that the NRA give for suggesting that gun control doesn't work, they use Chicago as an example. They say, well, in Chicago, they have strict gun control laws, but they also have a high rate of violence. Now, what they don't mention, the NRA, when they say that, is that most of the guns that are used in crimes in Chicago are brought in from nearby Indiana, where there are lax gun controls. So it's a phony argument, but one, obviously, that works with a lot of people. Is that your understanding, or do you follow the politics of gun control and of the NRA?
I'm a senior right now. So when I was in sophomore year, I took AP Gov, and so we were, like, studying all the laws and everything. And from what I remember, like, I don't know. I feel like it's just, like, it's not right for people to, like, just use Chicago as an example to, like, I guess justify why laws, like, strict laws for guns are not working. I feel like they just, like, it's the mindset, you know, like, it's, like, how people think and, like, first of all, like, what makes these people get the guns, you know? Like, I feel like there's just, like, a deeper thing that, like, people are not getting into.
Well, just in closing, Jatsiri, what do your parents think about what you're doing? And has anybody that you know, for example, any of your fellow students, had disagreements with their parents and their teachers, or are all of the adults in your life on board with what you're doing?
Yeah, although, like, right now I'm part of Make the Challenge, which is like a program that, like, supports youth boys. So, like, I'm pretty surrounded with, like, people that, like, support what I'm doing and what I believe in.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jatsiri Campos, who is a 17-year-old student at Munchen College Prep, a charter school in downtown Chicago. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.